The Holy Gospel according to St. Matthew, the 17th chapter. When they came to the crowd, a man came to Jesus, knelt before him, and said, "Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is an epileptic and he suffers terribly. He often falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, but they could not cure him." Jesus answered, "You faithless and perverse generation, how much longer must I be with you? How much longer must I put up with you? Bring him here to me." And Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of him, and the boy was cured instantly. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" He said to them, "Because of your little faith. For truly I tell you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you." The Gospel of the Lord. A Christian speaks to a madman. Today we will be taking a look at the United States' involvement in the country of Libya and the significance of that activity. Were it to be so easy that we could immediately go to Scripture, find a teaching of Jesus that would tell us exactly what to do and to put it into practice. But if you are taking note of the tone of the epistle lesson and the gospel lesson today, you will notice that there seems to be this juxtaposition between loving one another and defying that which is sinister. How then is a Christian supposed to be obedient to the will of God? To answer that question, we will first of all take a look at the historical teachings of the church related to the just war theory and also pacifism. Second, we will take a look at the American rationale for being involved in Libya. And finally, then, we will get to the question, how can one be obedient to the will of God? So let's start with the tradition of the church related to just war theory and pacifism. Just war theory and pacifism have at their heart some similar principles, and that is that there is a value to human life, and human life is to be so valued that human lives are never to be taken by force by anyone else. The just war theory has the longevity in the Christian tradition of the two perspectives. Now, certainly there have been conscientious objectors for centuries, and certainly the historic peace church tradition has lifted up pacifism, but in the Roman Catholic tradition and in the mainline traditions, just war theorists have longevity. But what we will discover is that within the last 50 years, pacifism has taken its place alongside the just war theorists. Why is it that pacifism has come to take more of a role in this conversation? In part, I think, because we have experienced the outcome of World War I and World War II and the thousands of people who have died. We have encountered the Vietnam War experience. And so our understanding of war has been informed by those significant wars. It's captured in some interesting quotes related to giving one's life for the country. The poet Horace states, "It is a sweet and fitting thing to die for one's country." Nathan Hale, a patriot, picks up that theme and says, "I only regret that I have but one life to lose for my country." But the change in thought is captured by Hemingway, who writes, "They wrote in the old days that it is sweet and fitting to die for one's country. But in modern wars, there is nothing sweet nor fitting in dying. You will die like a dog for no good reason." I saw a very real example of that in a conversation I had with a young man who was a confirmand of mine many years ago. He was one of those confirmation students that had a real playful side to him, you know, had always a good joke related to the lesson, never disruptive of the class, but sort of the joker of the class, a very light and free spirit. He just came back from Afghanistan. Came back from Afghanistan after his best friend in the army was killed as he stood next to him in battle. And there is now a weight on that young man's soul where it makes it hard to recognize his free and light spirit anymore. It's in part due to a change in how we see war that pacifism is gaining credibility in the way the church speaks to the use of the authority of coercion against others. James Finn, in an essay in the book War or Peace, says that now modern-day Christians have three areas that they are confronting as they deal with looking at war. The first is that we have nuclear superpower faced against other nuclear superpowers. Second, we have a nuclear superpower who is facing another country that has no nuclear weapons. And the third, which is the one that is most significant for our conversation today, is that we are facing countries that have significant liberation movements within them. And that challenges us as Christians, how we balance the respect for human life with the call for justice in those times when people are suffering under the weight of their nation's rulers. An American response then to what is happening in Libya. What makes up a government is that there is some kind of governing principles. For us, it's articulated in a written constitution. In some nations, it might be an unwritten but stated set of values. There is a government that upholds that constitution and democratic systems that has a majority and a minority, and they express their political will. The people give up some of their freedoms in order to live under that government, and that government has what we call the authority of coercion, that is to use power to control the behavior of others. It happens within our nation through the criminal justice system, that there are consequences, there are punishments when people break the law. But this authority of coercion can also be expressed when the nation is at risk, when it is threatened to defend its borders, to defend its common interests. But now, as we are faced with liberation movements within the world, we're being asked to think about an additional role for our government. And that is to use the authority of coercion to become involved in liberation movements in other nations. Will we use our force? Will we use our power to help those people who are living in unjust circumstances and to defend their cause? Our president, President Obama, in his speech on Monday night, gave this rationale for our government to do exactly that. That he sees that there is a potential massacre that would have stained what he calls the conscience of the world. And he refuses to wait for the images of slaughter and the mass graves before he's going to take action. A justifiable and good reason to use the authority of coercion in Libya. And when Reinhold Niebuhr was talking about statesmen, politicians, and how they make decisions, he says that the statesman is anxious about the order and security of the nation, maintaining the integrity of the nation, but he can't express this anxiety without also mixing into that decision-making process his own worry about his prestige as a ruler, and without assuming unduly that the only kind of order and security that is adequate for the nation's health is the order and security that he personally establishes. That is, each statesman believes the way that he establishes order and security is superior to everyone else's. That is significant for us, because as we live in a divided time, we have this assumption that if we liked George Bush as president, everything he did was right. And if we like Barack Obama as our president, everything he does is right. It is entirely possible, brothers and sisters, that President Bush made decisions that were right and good, and that he also made mistakes in his decision-making process. And it is entirely possible that President Obama can make decisions that are right and good, and also will make decisions that fail in that decision-making process. It calls for our discernment to move away from the person, away from the personality, to engage the idea, to engage the issue, not attack the person. So what I want to do is to take a look at, then, an American response. To lift up first where our politicians might get themselves into trouble. First of all, to base one's decision by talking about the perceived failures of one's predecessors. I know pastors are guilty of that. It would be so easy for me to come into a congregation and for me to point out all the failures of all my predecessors and then to present to you how I am the solution, the Messiah, if you will set the congregation straight. Pastors do it. Parents do it. Leaders do it. Statesmen do it. Using that as part of the argument is less than helpful. Second, using the justification of a coalition can be deceiving. If we are acting out of conscience, it is entirely possible that we will act on our own. Because as each people, each nation comes to their own decision, their conscience may lead them to another place. And to assume that we can accomplish this purpose by not setting any boot on Libyan soil is probably not realistic. We saw that happen in Iraq. That the shock and awe campaign on Baghdad that night was going to bring about a resolution to that dilemma. And it did not do that. An American response, I think, can be shaped in the following way. To understand, first of all, that it is the removal of Gaddafi that is the desired result. That it is under his despotic leadership that people are suffering and the mass murders are a possibility. And with his removal also are those who are closest to him who have the same school of thought. That may be accomplished militarily, but there are other resources available through the international community and other techniques that may also be able to accomplish that. Second, we must be sure that there is an alternative government and set of leaders available before we remove the first one. That vacuum is a horrible place to be. And it's not simply about reforming a bad government. One sociologist once said, the most scary thing he's ever encountered is a bad government trying to reform itself. We must understand that there is a liberation movement. There is a resistance in Libya. And to make the decision whether that leadership is capable of leading the nation. But those decisions cannot simply be based on what the media reports to us about the resistance. Listen to what the New York Times wrote about a similar resistance a number of years ago when generals close to this despot attempted to assassinate the ruler. The New York Times declared that those who had attempted to kidnap or kill the head of this state and the commander-in-chief of the army had done something that one would not normally expect among officers and would not normally expect in a civilized government. Chastising those who tried to bring the ruler down. It was a report about the generals who tried to assassinate Adolf Hitler. Finally, in a governmental response, it is also important for us to be aware that our president and our political leaders have information available to them that we do not have available to us. The intelligence community is an extraordinary resource for our leaders. I got to know someone from the intelligence community a couple months back, and for weeks, every time I saw him, I'd be afraid to ask him about work. And finally, I decided to take the risk and say, "So tell me about work." And he laughed. He said, "You've been holding off on doing that." I said, "I have." He goes, "Why?" "Because you're afraid I'd have to kill you after I talk to you." I said, "Exactly." How do we know the intelligence available and its impact? Time will tell us its reliability. It will reveal to us the purposes and the accomplishments of the decision. So can then a Christian obedient to the will of God support the use of the authority of coercion in a nation that is seeing a liberation movement come alive? Our new hymnal is an interesting resource. One of my frustrations with the new hymnal is that any hymn that had been in our previous hymnal that had militaristic language, any verse that had military language in it was removed in our new hymnal. So there are hymns that are missing some significant verses. But at the same time, in revising the hymnal and coming up with the new hymnal, an addition was made to the baptismal rite. And the addition was this: "Do you promise to defy the forces of evil in the world?" And that expresses the difficulty we have in deciding what is obedient to the will of God. Perhaps an example used by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a Lutheran pastor during Nazi Germany, who was executed for being part of the assassination plot against Hitler, said this: "Which one of you, when observing a madman driving down the street, killing everyone he could run over, would not make an attempt to grab the steering wheel out of his hands? Would not at some level of aggression make an attempt to stop what this man was doing?" It is that question that calls for us to ask, how can I be obedient to the will of God? To strive to be obedient to the will of God is first of all to understand that being a Christian is not about membership. Being a Christian is not about membership in a church. It's about discipleship. Those who follow Jesus Christ. It is not defined by the bare minimum requirements necessary to be a member in a congregation, but to follow Jesus with all of your heart and soul and strength. Second, to be obedient to the will of God. It challenges those of us who think that being a Christian is simply about me getting my personal spiritual life in order. And as long as I, as an individual, have my spiritual life in order, then that's all that is required. It is about full engagement in this world that God has created and that God will redeem. It's not individualistic. It can be, however, very lonely. As we each make the decision about being obedient to the will of God. Being obedient to the will of God challenges our common understanding of love as well. We want to use that standard, and if we love everybody, then we're not going to use anything that is aggressive to bring harm to anyone. The problem with that is that many times then, out of loving someone else, I will not make any decisions to bring people out of their suffering. Obedience to the will of God. As each of you reflect upon what it means to be obedient to the will of God, in our nation's decision to be involved, to use the authority of coercion in the nation of Libya because of its liberation movement, I will hope that you will take what I shared with you as a starting point for your thinking and decision making. It seems odd to use this text from Corinthians about love in a situation like what we're talking about today, but it's that last section that is rich for me. We see in a mirror dimly. It is not perfectly clear to us what is purely obedient to the will of God. But there are times when we are afraid to do the right thing for fear we might sin in the process. And that is why I claim to believe that what President Obama is doing is an appropriate action. I also throw myself upon the mercy of God, asking where my own self-service and self-justification is being an obstacle to being obedient to the will of God. Amen.